Now I'm going to read. You can keep talking on the phone. It's okay with me, but I'm going to read. After David was exorcised. After the exorcism was completed on September 9th, 1980, Arnie Johnson, the fiancé of his sister, who had cried out in the near-fatal exorcism of David for the demon to come into him and release David. Arnie is arrested for murder in February 1981. The exorcism of the 9th of September was not conclusive, as the book goes on to say. Only the priest left. The spirit did not. And you folks out there that are listening, this is one time the voices of faith are going to be frustrated. You keep them busy on the phone and they can't listen to what I'm doing. As Ed Warren explains, although the various exorcism procedures ultimately stopped the entity from possessing David, the spirit itself was not exorcised. At least not in the classical way the word is understood. And he says a mouthful there, because the church, through the centuries, has dealt with demons. The problem had to do with procedure. What was required all along was for a trained exorcist to be assigned to the case by church officials, diocesan officials, and given the authority to conduct major exorcism, the ritual Romanum. It was the only solution. There never was any other solution. What was possessing David had to be fully exorcised and then bound by command not to possess the child again and leave the family for good. Not just exorcised, but bound. Why didn't they? It's the only criticism I've ever heard these Catholic demonologists give of a section of their church. Instead, diocesan officials, accountable only to themselves, stood aloof. The devil in Connecticut, in our diocese, no one must know. We'll take care of it our own way. Their way was to do too little, too late. After September 2nd, when the need for correct procedure was critical, the diocese still refused to grant authority, either for major exorcism or for an exorcist. An old man, pious with the gift of discernment, who has commanded the devil before, none of the priests who performed the exorcism qualified for that. And the diocese refused to grant authority for a major exorcism or for an exorcist to be brought in to perform the task. In the words of this writer, because of pride or politics or lack of interest, this enormous job of exorcising David, which you know took more than one attempt because of their inexperience, the enormous job was left in the hands of four young priests in the field. And they got hurt because of it. Had someone in the chancery, I read this writer and Ed and Lorraine, the only time I've ever heard of a criticism of the church for them. Had someone in the chancery gotten off their throne and observed the great evil that was taking place in Brookfield, some positive move might have resulted. But what took place instead were two otherwise dedicated attempts at lesser exorcism. The result of these deliverance procedures was to stop the entity from possessing David. But the thing was not bound and expelled. It remained free to possess another. Disaster was not stopped. It was only deferred. Further exorcism was required. But unbelievably, the Chancery closed the book on the case at that point. Believe it or not, Father Vergulic was taken off the case in late September and sent to Rome. As Father D. Giovanni, earlier involved, had been sent to Rome. The local priests were instructed to return to their regular duties. The policy diocesan officials adopted, was that if the entity wasn't possessing David, then their job was done. And they stuck with that position. Instead of cooperation came hostility. Instead of peace came tragedy. A metaphysical time bomb was left ticking, in the words of this writer. Ed Warren's statements were confirmed by the Glatzel family. All of the above was direct quote from Ed Warren. Judy, the mother of David, summed it up in one terse comment. The church abandoned us. A week after the last exorcism took place in this house, Judy said, a monk arrived here late at night in a limousine. He and his chauffeur came in and stayed an hour and a half. Father Vergulic was present that night too. This is the words of David's mother. The monk was pompous and rude. Ed Warren called him an official church debunker. He declared that we were all crazy and that David wasn't possessed, even though Father Vergulic, now sent to Rome, was present and performed the exorcism. His chauffeur blamed Debbie for all the trouble. He said the only devils that exist are Rockefeller and the crooks in Washington. He said that exorcism wasn't needed in this case, and then he left. He insulted me, my family, and Father Vergulic, who subsequently would be sent within a matter of days or weeks to Rome, banished. From that point on, we never got any help, Judy, the mother of David, said, from the diocese again. They turned their back on us. There wasn't anything we could do about it. The beast was given a free hand to act, and it did. And I'm delighted to point out that the Catholic Church is not as monolithic as some people think it is. Official policy does not always filter down and make robots out of every Christian within the Catholic Church. Ultimately, to get the job done, they're going to have to leave the New England diocese and go to Canada, to Quebec, where they find a mature exorcist who then will come down and finish the job on David. But it was too late for Arne Johnson. Incomprehensible as it may seem, this is the situation that prevailed after the summer of 1980. The beast was given a free hand to act, and it did. The result was a downslide into catastrophe. In September, says Debbie Glatzel, the thing possessed David a few more times just to show us it was here. But toward the end of the month and into October, the figure directed its attention to little Carl and turned him into a violent madman. We were living in hell again. None of us had any way of stopping this thing. The priests had been scattered, and as a consequence, we all became victims. Carl, for example, pulled a loaded shotgun on me and threatened to rearrange my face. He sent Alan to the hospital with stab wounds in his stomach from an iron rake, and my mother was black and blue from trying to break up these battles. Most of the time, Carl's excessive anger was directed against Arnie, my mother, and me. Arnie became his favorite target. He destroyed every shred of clothing Arnie had. He cut up his music tapes. He destroyed cartons of cigarettes as soon as they were brought home. He ruined Arnie's new work boots by filling them with axle grease the day he got them. Carl, or rather the beast working through him, did everything he could to break Arnie down, but Arnie never broke. He shouldered it all. It took the beast to step in finally and ruin him. By mid-October, havoc in the family became so violent and threatening that Brookfield police were called to the Glatzels' home once, sometimes twice a week. It was only the Warrens' intercession that saved young Carl from being taken away by the police to the juvenile detention center. The police didn't know why they were perpetually responding to disturbance calls at the Glatzel property, and they were beginning to lose patience, said Lorraine Warren. In October, it became necessary to inform them in as discreet a manner as possible that a theological case was in progress with the Glatzel family, one that had required church involvement since July. It was explained that the source of the trouble was not the people, but rather an unexercised force that was oppressing them. And that's what I read earlier. The chief of police's department report in October 1980, reporting these calls from the Warrens. The potential for violence in the case had become a reality, the police were told, and even the possibility of death could not be ruled out. They were requested to keep the family under surveillance, but not to arrest anyone unless it was absolutely necessary. Fortunately, the police agreed, and oppression of young Carl died down naturally in November. In October 1980, Mary Johnson fled the rental house in Newtown with Arnie's young sisters. Day by day, all summer and into the fall, little incidents kept building until the girls were so frightened they refused to go into the house without their mother. This is the first house where the story started. Not only did Mary Johnson and the girls see things, hear things, and feel things, but their personalities were changed by the house. They fought fiercely among themselves. Nothing went right. By October, living in the house had also broken them financially. As a result, they were forced to return to Bridgeport, where they live today. In late November, Arnie and Debbie also made a move. We're getting ready for the murder now. Debbie's job at the kennels in Newtown had been phased out in September, but the owner had recommended her to Alan Bono, the new manager of the Brookfield Kennels on Route 7, not far from the Glatzels' home. Mr. Bono telephoned Debbie in late October and offered her a job and a free apartment if she came to work for him. The apartment was in the four-unit block he managed on the property along with the kennels. Debbie took the job and the apartment. Mr. Alan Bono was a very nice man, said Debbie. He was 39 years old, had spent the last 17 years in Australia. His stories were fascinating. And he'd been back in America for about a year and was managing the property for his brother-in-law. But he didn't know anything about the kennel work. In fact, he hated animals. He begged me to take the job, but at first I told him no because the kennel runs were filthy and the animals weren't being treated properly. But then he called me back again. This time offered the apartment. Given the constant war going on with Carl Jr., I took the job so that Arnie and I could get out of the house and start our life together. So in late November, Arnie, Debbie, and Jason moved to the Route 7 apartment. Arnie continued to work full-time as a tree surgeon while Debbie managed the kennels for Alan Bono. With two incomes and no rent to pay, they could save their money, and they were planning to get married in the spring. But there would be no spring. There would be no marriage. With the move to the new apartment, The stage was now set for disaster. Arnie was now installed at the scene of the crime. Alan Bono would be the victim. In the Glatzel house, activity had calmed down by December. Yet the beast remained present in its array of 43 forms. They knew it was there because it still talked to David, telling him future events which he passed on to the family. By the onset of the winter, the entity was simply a lurking presence. "What is the beast doing today, David?" Judy would ask. "He's just waiting," he says. David would reply. "Waiting for what?" she'd ask. "He won't tell me," David always answered. The fact that the entity remained is the telling link between the summer possession case and the February murder. That which remained had the potential to possess again, and it did. The victim, though, was not David, nor was it young Carl. The victim was Arnie Johnson. Now, Arnie Johnson's in prison, sentenced until 2001 A.D. I received a call the other night telling me he was listening in prison that night in Connecticut. It's the strangest murder case on record. His defense, the demon did it, while the victim was at least 10 to 15 or 20 feet from him. The judge obviously didn't believe that. Translated his plea into insanity, then denied it because a technical paper requesting the insanity plea had not been filed. And he was sentenced, found guilty and sentenced on circumstantial evidence. We'll see what those present at the killing have to say. During the summer, Arnie had experienced two flagrant possession seizures, the second of which was a humiliating scene in church. On November 4th, Arnie came under possession a third time. Arnie and Debbie had gone to the rental house in Newtown to check on Mrs. Johnson and the girls, hopefully to repair relations. However, when they got to the house, they discovered it was vacant, as she and the girls had fled 2 weeks earlier. Both Arnie and Debbie were glad to see she was gone. Debbie refused to stay in the house and immediately went outside, where she ran into the landlord's daughter and friend. A minute later, when Arnie walked out of the house, he was possessed. It happened suddenly and unexpectedly, the minute he shut the door and put his feet on the front step. "First, Arnie's body trembled violently all over," said Debbie. "Then the whole appearance of his face changed into the same hating sneer that we saw in David all summer. What stood there was not Arnie. What stood there was the beast again, like the master of the house. I almost fainted. It..." You know, I like it better when you can listen to me in here. I think I'm going to play some more music. I'm going to play some more music. And you take all the calls at King's House 1. I'm going to stop the calls in here, because I'm getting down to the nitty-gritty now. By the way, I'm always glad when King's House is from out of town business. We have a King's House from Appleton, Wisconsin, sitting over there on the phone taking your calls tonight. All of you folks there, welcome from Appleton, Wisconsin. They're coming from all over the nation now, and it's nice to have a family one day that'll be reaching around the world. Come on over, Ron, want some live music. This time, Debbie was the only witness. And you don't think I'm crazy for staying with demonology, do you? The entity possessed Arnie as fully and completely as it had the other three times. As with the other previous incidents, There was no talking or communication. That which seized Arnie was preoccupied with rage. For the long 5 minutes that the possession lasted, it virtually ignored Debbie, but angrily punched a hole through a thick wooden chest before withdrawing. Not even a karate expert could do what he did, noted Debbie. The next morning, there wasn't even a mark on Arnie's hand. Keep going. If you come to King's House 1 next Sunday, you can have this book. It was the final two possessions of Arnie that led to catastrophe. They took place within 10 minutes of each other. They were both fierce attempts at murder. The sixth and last episode of possession resulted in death. There was no intent or premeditation on Arnie Johnson's part to harm anyone. His body was simply seized and used as an instrument to kill. The victim was his friend. Why the murder occurred precisely on February 16th was not known at the time, but the date was not random. A death was bound to occur on that day. The victim was irrelevant, for what was sought by the possessing entity was a human soul. In fact, the intended victim was Debbie Glatzel. But Alan Bono was killed instead. Am I boring you? The reason why the entity chose to work through Arnie Johnson was the culminating iniquity. The burden of murder was imposed on him in direct retribution for his challenges to the beast at the time it possessed David Glatzel. In the end, what took place was not just murder. It was a diabolical execution. The night before the killing occurred, Arnie and Debbie drove to Bridgeport and picked up Wanda, Janice, and little Mary, Arnie's sisters. It was Sunday night. The next day, not the same day. No, the very next day. What's that? You learn quick. Like a good news for Dallas, Fort Worth. They led all satellite cities in giving during the month of October. Only surpassed by Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New England. New England, almost 70,000. San Francisco, a little over 200,000. And Los Angeles, 450,000. Dallas gave 12,000. Now that, in comparison to a $1 million budget, isn't that much. That leads all satellite cities. And they've only got about 30,000 to go. And they would have broken the black the first month. We said spend between $40,000 and $50,000 in Dallas. I'm glad you applauded them. I also want applause for my crew on anniversary Sunday. They made it look easy. The engineering was superb. It includes the ushers, includes security, engineering, directing, the people that stayed at home to keep the wheels turning. My crew has never been better. And I was proud of them. It was Sunday night. The next day, George Washington's birthday was a holiday in Connecticut. And the girls had no school, so they were going to stay overnight with Arnie and Debbie. I don't have to read to you. I can just sit here and read it to myself. Interesting. Really is. You ought to have this book. You can have it next Sunday. Relations between Arnie and Debbie and the Johnsons had promptly returned to normal when Mary moved out of the rental house. That's where all the trouble started, the waterbed, remember? On Monday, February 16th, 1981, Arnie Johnson got up at 7 o'clock as usual. He had to be at work by 8. Aren't you glad you lived long enough to find that out? He had to be at work at 8. However, for the first time in a long while, he felt ill. He had a throbbing headache, an upset stomach, and a chest condition, congestion. He simply couldn't function. He couldn't function, and at 7:15 a.m. he called in sick. Debbie gave him 2 aspirin and an antibiotic. Tetracycline, inaccurately identified later by authorities as Mytown. And he returned to bed. With the chatter and the commotion, you want me to hurry, don't you? It's too exciting. With the chatter and commotion caused by his little sisters, however, Arnie couldn't sleep, and he got up for the day shortly after 10. He felt considerably better at that point, but he wasn't well. Meanwhile, the kennels were open for business that day, and Debbie had a number of grooming assignments, and the girls were eager to watch. Debbie introduced the 3 girls to Alan Bono, who later invited the entire group, including Arnie, out to lunch. Alan wasn't married, ate in restaurants almost all the time, Debbie remembers. He liked to take people out and buy them lunch just to have company. He was lonely and melancholy, too. He talked about death every day. Arnie and I made friends with him just so that he would have friends, but he was a very heavy drinker, an alcoholic. His drinking impaired any ability he might have had to run the kennels, which he hated. The animals were completely ignored. Expensively boarded pets got no food or water, even no heat. Some died. By 11 o'clock the morning of the murder, Alan was already half-cropped on white wine. At lunchtime, Alan took us out to a nearby restaurant where we all had hamburgers and Coke. except Alan, who put away a couple of carafes of wine. Alan insisted we drink wine with him. Arnie didn't want to, but we each drank about a glassful. Alan kept topping them up until we let the wine glasses set full. After lunch, we stopped at a pet supply store and got shampoo and other supplies for the dogs I had to groom that afternoon. When we were there, it was odd, but a big parrot climbed onto Arnie's shoulder and sat there all the time we were in the place. Wouldn't get off, pecked at people who came too near him. On the way back, we made a stop at the liquor store so Alan could buy a big bottle of red wine to work on before dinner. Too cold. When we returned, Arnie went up to the apartment for a short nap. I brought the girls to the grooming parlor, and Alan went to work on the wine in the downstairs office. It was when we came back to the kennels after lunch that I began to think something was wrong and that something tragic was going to happen. By 4 p.m., that sense of impending tragedy was equally as strong in Judy Glatzel. She wasn't there. She began calling the kennels every half hour, demanding that Debbie and Arnie get away from the kennels and return to the Glatzel's house immediately. Debbie sensed what her mother was talking about and promised to bring Arnie and the girls over to the house for dinner at 6. By 5 that afternoon, Arnie was up and feeling better. It had turned into a fine day. Arnie joined Alan Bono in the ground floor kennel office and was asked if he could fix the speaker wiring in the man's stereo. Arnie set about the task while Debbie and the girls were grooming in the back. The poodle was finished, and the grooming parlor was cleaned up by 5:30 p.m. when Judy called again. The instructions were straightforward. Get the hell home. I told her that something was terribly, terribly wrong, Judy recalled. I knew there was going to be a tragedy, and if we were together, maybe it could be prevented. But by now, Alan Bono was fully inebriated. At the time of death, his alcohol intake registered 3 times the legal limit of 3.3 on a 1.0 scale. Alan insisted that they stay and have dinner with him. Debbie resisted. But he created such an obnoxious scene that she capitulated and finally ordered 3 pizzas. Shortly before 6, Debbie and the 3 girls went out to pick up the pizzas. Arnie, meanwhile, went up to the apartment to check on George, their sheepdog, and to change out of his work boots and into shoes. Curiously, the shoes that Arnie put on belonged to David. It was 6 o'clock when Debbie and Arnie's sisters returned with the unwanted pieces. They found Arnie in the kennel office with Alan Bono, who was still drinking wine. The stereo had been fixed, and he seemed pleased. I suggested that we have the pieces up in Alan's apartment, Debbie recalled. I'd seen it before, and I knew Alan was going to get drunker and fall asleep. And I wanted him to pass out in his apartment, not ours. So I went upstairs, set out the pizzas on his kitchen table, and called everybody when it was ready. Alan came up last. He brought his wine with him. He also turned the stereo up real loud. It wasn't very pleasant. Alan Bono was so drunk that he could barely walk, and he was distinctly not interested in eating. As soon as the others sat down, Alan turned on the television set, even though the stereo was blaring rock music downstairs, but the television wouldn't work, and Alan began shaking the set and yelling at it. Debbie told him to settle down, but Alan was obvious. He began to bang on the wall so violently with his fist that he put a hole in the plasterboard. Although no one at the table had taken more than one bite of pizza, Arnie and Debbie stood up and told the girls they were to leave immediately. Neither Arnie nor I wanted the girls to be in the presence of this drunken, violent man, said Debbie. And we both felt it would be best if we got in the car and went directly to my parents' house. We were certainly not going to stay in the middle of that ugly spectacle. Arnie led the way down the stairs with Debbie right behind him. At the bottom of the stairs was the door to the kennel office. Arnie darted in to turn off the blaring stereo. When Arnie emerged from the office, Debbie was holding open the front door. But the girls did not follow. Upstairs, Alan Bono, drunk, was blocking their way. It was at this moment that the fifth possession of Arnie occurred. Arnie walked past me as I held open the door for the girls, and then he stopped about 2 feet away, Debbie recalled. I had just yelled for the girls to come downstairs. Then I turned to get Arnie's reaction. When I saw him, I shouted, "Oh no." It wasn't Arnie standing there. It was the beast in him. The eyes, the mouth, everything was changed. The next thing I heard was a terrible, loud growl come out of Arnie. Seconds later. Now, we're a little out of practice. Let's try it again. The next thing I heard was a terrible, loud growl. Come out of Arnie. Seconds later. I turned to get Arnie's reaction. When I saw him, I shouted, "Oh, no." It wasn't Arnie standing there. The beast was in him. The eyes, the mouth, everything was changed. The next thing I heard was a terrible, loud growl. Come out of Arnie. Seconds later. Then I turned to get Arnie's reaction. I just want to see if I've lost the ability to squeeze things. When I saw him, I shout. I don't ever want to lose the ability to squeeze things. Then I turned to get Arnie's reaction. When I saw him, I shouted, "Oh, no." It wasn't Arnie standing there. The beast was in him. The eyes, the mouth, everything was changed. The next thing I heard was a terrible, loud growl come out of Arnie. Seconds later. Now, what we want to know is what happened seconds later after the growl. They're not really in it tonight, Jerry. Let's squeeze them a little more. Then I turned to get Arnie's reaction. When I saw him, I shouted, "That's getting better. Let's do it again." Then I turned to get Arnie's reaction. When I saw him, I shouted, "Oh, no!" It wasn't Arnie standing there. The beast was in him. The eye, the mouth, everything was changed. The next thing I heard was a terrible, loud growl. Come out of Arnie. Are you Arnie? Seconds later. Now, later is later and not now, so we'll wait a few seconds to see if you want me to continue. We've got to get back in the habit of squeezing things. What I said. Now, going to join Los Angeles and San Diego and Reno. I'd like to squeeze on them a little, too. What do you mean we're already with them? Why doesn't people remind me on Monday that they come on at 11 o'clock? You mean that I have growl for me? Well, Reno's not with us. I'll squeeze them. Every drop out of them. Every living drop. Seconds later. What's that?